Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. One family was permanently displaced and another displaced temporarily Sunday after fire ravaged a duplex at 1237 Downing Court near Fred Becker Elementary School. According to Lieutenant Tony McGrain, the fire started in the bedroom and crews from Waterloo Fire Rescue were dispatched around 9 a.m. Severe smoke damage to both sides of the duplex caused the tenants of both units to be displaced. No one was injured, and crews completed an aggressive interior attack to extinguish the blaze, which was confined to a second-floor bedroom. At one point, smoke filled the surrounding neighborhood. Katie Edsel was preparing for the day when she noticed smoke from her window. "Our entire area was filled with smoke," she said. Residents of the home did not want to give their names, but a family member on the scene confirmed they lost most of what they owned. "We are not from here, so it's hard to rely on family at a time like this," one of the residents said. McGrain confirmed the families affected were put in contact with the Red Cross. A family has been displaced after lightning struck their home late Friday night. According to Waterloo Fire Rescue, lightning struck the home at 623 Campbell Avenue. Flames then engulfed the back portion of the home. The family was able to escape without injury, and family pets were later rescued. A representative from Waterloo Fire Rescue confirmed the damage was significant. A man was airlifted in critical condition to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City after a single vehicle accident Saturday night. Cedar Falls Police, Cedar Falls Fire Rescue, Black Hawk County Sheriff's Office deputies, and Mercy One Ambulance Service all responded to the area of North Union Road and Skyline Drive near Beaver Hills Country Club for a single vehicle motorcycle accident. The driver was wearing a helmet and protective riding gear. The driver of the motorcycle has not yet been identified, and the accident remains under investigation by the Black Hawk County Sheriff's Office. A two-vehicle accident on Waterloo's west side caused a vehicle to flip over Sunday. According to police, Rachel Ruiz, 25, of Waterloo, ran a yield sign at the corner of Plymouth Avenue and Ohio Street near Kittrell Elementary School and collided with Al Nedarverik, also from Waterloo. Ruiz was driving a 2024 Honda HRV that flipped over. Ruiz, who was wearing her seatbelt, was not injured. She was later cited for failure to yield. Former Iowa City man will serve almost three decades in prison for the opioid death of Buchanan County resident. Court records indicate this is the second time Kevin Lorenzo Perry has been convicted in connection with a fentanyl death in Iowa. Judge Leonard Strand sentenced Perry, 34, recently of Austell, Georgia, to 27 years behind bars on charges of distribution of fentanyl resulting in death in U.S. District Court on Thursday. The prison time had been agreed upon during plea negotiations. Court records allege Perry sold $250 worth of what was supposed to be heroin to a man identified as J.T. in Buchanan County on February 6, 2020. J.T. was found dead of fentanyl and acetylfentanyl intoxication the following morning, and investigators found a fentanyl mix in a bag on his desk. 12 years of the sentence will run concurrent with 22 years Perry is serving for drug charges for two people who overdosed, one fatally, on fentanyl in Iowa City in May of 2020. Following the overdoses, Investigators set up a controlled purchase, and Perry arrived with 0.18 grams of fentanyl. Officers also found evidence of drug sales going back to 2018. He was sentenced in the Iowa City case in June 2022, and charges in the Buchanan County death were filed in April of 2023. An Independence man has been arrested for allegedly submitting false information when he purchased three guns in Cedar Falls. Joshua Richard Smith, 39, was arrested Thursday on three counts of false information in acquiring a firearm. He was later released pending trial. Independence police searched his home on 8th Street Northwest in November during a drug investigation. Officers found marijuana, pipes, and other paraphernalia, as well as 12 firearms, according to court records. Three of the guns, a bolt-action Ruger American rifle, a Springfield Armory Hellcat pistol, and a Sig Sauer P320 pistol, had been purchased at Shields Sporting Goods store in Cedar Falls in 2020. Authorities allege Smith falsely claimed he was not an illegal drug user on ATF forms when he purchased the weapons, according to court records. A Florida man has been arrested after Bremer County Sheriff's deputies found a large amount of meth in his vehicle during a traffic stop over the weekend. Deputies pulled over a Chevrolet Silverado pickup truck traveling 77 MPH in a 65 MPH zone on U.S. Highway 218 around 1:15 a.m. Sunday. Authorities noticed a glass pipe in the vehicle, and further investigation turned up a gallon zip plastic bag of meth, two bottles of prescription drugs, and a scale, according to court records. The driver, 62-year-old Stephen Gerald Lawrence of Winter Haven, Florida, was arrested for possession of meth with intent to deliver, violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act, and two counts of unlawful possession of a prescription drug. Bond was set at $25,000. A Bremer County man has been charged in a road rage incident that happened in March. Tracy Buchholz, 52, of Tripola, allegedly used a tractor to block an oncoming vehicle from passing in the 1500 block of Midway Avenue near Tripola. Buchholz allegedly approached and assaulted the male driver of the vehicle. Buchholz was charged with third-degree harassment, simple assault not causing injury, and tampering with a witness or juror. All three charges are misdemeanors. The victim was a witness who testified against Buchholz in an August trial in which Buchholz pleaded guilty and was sentenced to prison on two counts of assault with intent to commit sexual abuse in Bremer County District Court. He is free on an appeal bond. Buchholz was released from jail on the recent charges with a $2,000 cash bond. A Waterloo couple has been arrested after a relative was found living with untreated bed sores and other ailments in January. Police arrested Jerry Lee Richards Trask, 51, and Sunshine Marie Trask, 40, on Thursday for charges of intentional dependent adult abuse, a felony. They were later released pending trial. Court records indicate Richards Trask's 66-year-old sister was found with bed sores that went almost to the bone. Per medical providers treating her, her condition resulted from sitting in a chair or lying in a bed for months without access to repositioning, adequate hygiene, or regular medical care, court records state. The woman had been diagnosed with mental illness as a child and had been cared for by her mother. The mother passed away 9 years ago, and Richards Trask took over the court-ordered guardianship in 2015 and oversaw her daily activities, records state. During a June 2023 medical visit, doctors expressed concern about the condition of the woman's skin and suggested moving her to a higher level of care, but no follow-up visits were scheduled. Then, on January 11, 2024, paramedics were called to their home at 639 Wallgate Avenue and found the woman on the floor covered in urine and feces, records state. She was taken to Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center for treatment, where doctors noticed the bed sores and found she was suffering from COVID-19 and sepsis. She was placed on a respirator and later moved to a Des Moines hospital. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services sought an emergency order to treat the woman in March, while measures were taken to find an alternate guardian, court records state. The Board of Education in Waterloo got an earful during a recent public hearing about how a proposed increase in tax collections would impact Waterloo Community School District residents. A new state law requires all local governments to hold an additional public hearing on the maximum property tax levy prior to approving a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Ahead of those hearings, a mailing sent to all property owners detailed the current and proposed tax collections and tax rate. For Waterloo schools, that includes a $2.55 million increase in tax collections, or 6.94%, to $39.36 million. The tax rate would grow 62 cents to $13.98 per $1,000 of taxable valuation. The mailing also included the tax impact on residential and commercial properties at a particular assessed value, and that's what Pat Mule of Evansdale took issue with. Mule, one of five homeowners who spoke during the hearing last week, pointed out that the example of a tax bill on a home assessed at $100,000 doesn't account for a Blackhawk County assessor's revaluation taking effect for the fiscal year starting July 1st. That's true for the examples given of county and city taxes owed as well. All show a drop in the taxes that would be owed under the proposed levy. She told the board, "Your information lulls the taxpayer into thinking our property tax bill will be less, even though you are raising our tax levy. I fear thousands of residents will have heart failure when they open their tax bill this fall. You should have adjusted the property value of the 2024 example to properly reflect the increase based on the Blackhawk County Assessor's new valuation. With the new value of Mule's home, the district portion of her property taxes would rise 20% rather than dropping by 11.32% in the mailing's example of a home assessed at $100,000. Michael Chapman of Waterloo highlighted the reasons for the proposed increase in tax collections listed on the mailing. Those included replacing lost federal funding, maintaining programs, and offsetting inflation. I wish all of us in this room and on fixed incomes could also offset inflation, but we can't," he said. "The lost federal funding, when that was initiated for COVID, everyone was well aware it was going to be temporary. I find it fiscally irresponsible for the school board to use those funds in a future budget." Chapman suggested getting rid of some expenditures that aren't necessary. He and Waterloo resident Cheryl Christensen, another speaker at the hearing, mentioned a proposed expansion of Central Middle School and the Waterloo Career Center to house a new merged grades 10 to 12 high school as a project they don't think should go forward. Waterloo school officials propose using 1% sales tax funds available to the district to fund that project rather than property tax dollars. Forrest Dillaboo of Waterloo alluded to a recent district purchase of farmland across to Katoski Drive from the proposed school site in voicing his concerns with proposed tax increase. That land would be used for a planned agricultural program at the Career Center and could be later part of district athletic fields. Waterloo resident Glenn Anderkay said a bigger budget should be tied to increased academic achievement in the district. He says if the board wants more money, then have better performance. Anderkay noted he would only be willing to support a decrease in the budget. When changes are seen in student achievement, then we will support you 1,000,000%. The well-known Deary family is expanding its footprint on Main Street beyond the corridor between University Avenue and Searley Boulevard. It's looking to execute a plan for the property that was formerly home to Simpson Furniture and Art Van Furniture at 2300 Main Street. Doing business as 7D LLC, the hope is to add an auto detailing shop in approximately 36,000 square feet of the 50,000 square foot space on the north end of the building, according to Chris Fischels, representing Deary. Brakes Plus sits on the south end at 2322 Main Street. He said another 3,600 square feet is expected to be a dentist's office, and the other 10,400 square feet is still available for lease. The building had undergone renovations and new construction, changing the footprint and parking configuration. The Planning and Zoning Commission heard from officials last week regarding a rezoning proposition, changing the property from M1 light industrial to C2 retail commercial to allow for the dental office of Spencer Walker, or what's classified as a human care institution. Officials describe C2 as a downgraded designation that does not allow for more intensive industrial uses like body work. The panel could act on April 10th. The proposal also includes 2216 Main Street and 127 East 23rd Street, once hosting single-family units registered as rentals, but demolished in 2023, according to the city. The Deary's purchased the parcels in 2022. The family already has staples like Dan Deary Toyota and Deary Brothers Collision Center along that strip of Main Street, south of the new roundabout being constructed at the Searley Boulevard intersection. The detailing center would offer a paint booth, detailing space, and photo booth space, the proposal states. The paint booth will offer touch-up minor scratches and dings, and occasionally remove bumpers for painting. Workers will detail clean vehicles, cleaning the inside and outside of the vehicles, including vacuuming, buffing, waxing, and sealing the paint. They will also use this space to add ceramic coating and undercoating. The photo booth space will offer the opportunity to showcase the work completed with videos and photographs for website listings. Pony Express riders of Iowa passed through Black Hawk County on Friday, but they came in vehicles rather than on horseback. Held every year on Easter weekend to raise funds for Easter Seals Iowa and Camp Sunnyside, a camp in Des Moines for children with disabilities, the route goes from Kelmer to Evansdale, then into Waterloo and Hudson. Over the years, local horse riders have volunteered to participate on legs of the route. No one joined on the route into Waterloo on Friday, but a police escort was waiting as the vehicles came from Evansdale. The group made its way to City Hall, where participants were met by Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart and Waterloo Police Chief Joe Leibold. Group members went on to Grundy Center and Conrad on Saturday, parading through each city as they made their way to Des Moines. On Thursday, Waterloo Waterworks will flush water mains in the Greenbrier area from Cedar Bend Street to Candlewick Road from West Donald Street to Greenbrier Road. Customers living within the area or within several blocks of the area could experience some discoloration. Water may be brownish color during and immediately after flushing. Customers should not plan to wash laundry on Thursday. The water is bacterially safe. Barbara Ashton, a professor of music therapy at Wartburg College, will present a free NAMI program, Music and Mental Health, from 7 to 8 p.m. April 10th in the lower level of the First Congregational Church, 608 West 4th Street in Waterloo. Ashton is a board-certified music therapist, has a master's in music, and is currently pursuing a Ph.D. in music therapy. Her interactive presentation will include music improvisation with a variety of instruments, a songwriting experience, and music-based relaxation. NAMI Black Hawk County works to improve the lives of all individuals affected by mental illness. For more information, call 319-830-6448. The Northeast Iowa Food Bank has declared its recent Empty Bowls event a success, raising hunger awareness and more than $34,000. The event, held March 22nd at the Hilton Garden Inn in Cedar Falls, drew more than 300 guests. Since it started locally in 2006, the Empty Bowls event has become a staple for the food bank, and a lot of planning goes into it each year. We have two full-time staff members working on the event for months leading up to it, said Jared Figenbaum, NEIFB Community Engagement Manager, and then about 20 staff members who help in the days before and at the event itself. The event featured soup, bread and dessert, silent and live auctions, and a raffle. From everyone at the Northeast Iowa Food Bank, we are incredibly thankful for our community and their support in alleviating hunger in Northeast Iowa, said Barbara Prather, NEIFB Executive Director. Collaborating, educating, and advocating is how we solve problems and make change. The food bank distributes nutritious food and grocery products to more than 140 nonprofit organizations and programs that help those facing food insecurity. Last year, it distributed more than 7 million meals within its 16-county service area. For more than 40 years, the NEIFB has alleviated hunger and provided nutrition education through its programs. A Clear Lake-based nonprofit has been working to fill shelves and racks with items for its new thrift store in Waterloo. One Vision Thrift Store opened Monday at 2060 Sovia Drive, Suite 115. One Vision supports people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The organization opened its doors in 1971 in Clear Lake as a campus of 10 houses to provide support for people with disabilities. Formerly known as Handicap Village and Opportunity Village, it now serves more than 300 people in 23 communities in northern Iowa. While the nonprofit is not bringing its programs to the Cedar Valley, thrift store revenues will support its work as well as provide employment opportunities. This is One Vision's third thrift store, with the other two in Clear Lake and Fort Dodge. Shelby Fleming, the store's brand manager, and her team have been working to set up the 10,000 square foot building since the beginning of March. The sales floor takes up 75% of that space. She said more than 10,000 items have been put out for sale, although the store is not as full as she wants it to be. There are racks of men's, women's, and children's clothes, shoes, bags, jewelry and accessories, home decor, kitchenwares, and furniture. The current stock came from excess donations at the other two stores. There are no set prices, and everything gets marked according to its value. Fleming said the average price of a piece of adult clothing is around $8, while children's clothing is around $4. The average price of everything in the store is $6. Fleming said the organization decided to create a store in Waterloo because it saw a need. She said they looked at the Ames and Des Moines areas, but settled on the Cedar Valley. Based on the median income and population, the need for a thrift store was really here, she said. Local partners also enticed them. The organization previously partnered with Exceptional Persons Incorporated, another group that works with people with disabilities. Fleming said the organization could partner with EPI to employ those with special needs. Apart from assisting an underserved community, One Vision hopes to further provide the area with a place to recycle unwanted goods. Our goal is to provide quality used items for the community while also helping a community keep things out of their landfill, Fleming said. We're hoping to bring jobs and volunteer opportunities and partnership opportunities. In 2023, the organization saved 1.5 million pounds of items from the landfill. She expects that number will be above 2 million pounds this year. Items that don't sell are mailed to other organizations to sell, recycle, and repurpose. The store is open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. The donation drop-off is open whenever the store is open. The store accepts most items except large appliances, baby furniture such as cribs and car seats, stereos and VHS tapes, encyclopedias and textbooks, items with odor or excess animal hair, non-working electrical items, paint or hazardous materials, tires, TVs, computers, or ruined items. Apart from assisting an underserved community, One Vision hopes to further provide the area with a place to recycle the unwanted goods. Nationally known author, artist, and sexual assault survivor Chanel Miller will be the keynote speaker at the Riverview Center's 5th Annual Luncheon of Light, April 19th at Bienvenue Events Center. The event is from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Tickets are $50 per person, available at riverviewcenter.org. Space is limited. There also will be an auction of items donated by local businesses, and Riverview staff will share stories about the impact of center services. On June 2, 2016, Stanford University athlete Brock Turner was found guilty of sexually assaulting an unconscious woman outside of a fraternity house. When Miller, known as Emily Doe, read her victim impact statement, the 7,000-word description of the assault's effect on her life went viral. "My damage was internal, unseen. I carry it with me. You took away my worth, my privacy, my energy, my time, my safety, my intimacy, my confidence, my own voice until today," she said that day in court. Turner was found guilty of 3 felony counts of sexual assault with a maximum sentence of 14 years, but Judge Aaron Persky sentenced Turner to 6 months in jail. He served 3 months. Miller went public with her real name in 2019 and wrote a memoir, Know My Name. "National events come to feel local in our work. I've read her book and her victim statement, and I'm impressed by the amazing grace and resilience she has shown. I'm impressed that she has used her experience as a platform to move forward and inform others," said Gwen Bramlett-Hecker, Riverview Center Executive Director. Riverview Center provides sexual assault services. "We offer help to victims so they can heal and thrive beyond the trauma and provide an adequate amount of support as they move forward," Bramlett Hecker said. Services are free and include 24-hour crisis hotlines, legal, medical, and social service advocacy, counseling, therapy, transition, and basic needs assistance. Riverview Center was founded in 1992 by Vicki Grattan, a Galena, Illinois Police Department nurse, and Faye Clark, a mental health therapist, after witnessing gaps in services available to sexual assault survivors in Joe Davies County. Riverview Center provides sexual and domestic violence services in two Illinois counties, and services have expanded to encompass counties in northeast Iowa, including Black Hawk, Benton, Bremer, Clayton, Fayette, Chickasaw, Howard, Jones, Lynn, Alamakee, and Winnesheek counties. We are the only agency in 14 counties of northeast Iowa that provides sexual assault services and providing crisis and emergency services, Bramlett Hecker said. I think we've all been taught stranger danger, but we have to come to terms with the fact that people usually are victims of sexual assault and violence at the hands of someone they know, love, and trust. 60% of adults know and trust the person who sexually assaults them, while statistically 90% of children know their abusers. Sexual assault and violence is about power and control, she said. Miller's victim impact statement was read on the floor of Congress. It also spurred changes in California law, including the recall of the judge in the case. She received an outpouring of support from the public, including praise for her courage in sharing her story. In her best-selling memoir, Miller told her story and reclaimed her identity. She was named one of Forbes 30 Under 30 and a Time Next 100 honoree. A writer and artist, she received her bachelor's degree in literature from the University of California, State Santa Barbara. There will be a short question-answer period following Miller's presentation at the Riverview Center luncheon. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Larry Robert Driesman, 83, of Grundy Center, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, March 26, 2024. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Larry was born on December 21, 1940. He graduated from Dyke High School and following graduation spent 3 years in the Army. On December 21, 1961, he married his high school sweetheart, Joyce Bacher, and they recently celebrated their 62nd wedding anniversary. Larry and Joyce were longtime members of Lincoln Center Christian Reformed Church. Larry spent 17 years as the manager of the Church of Brethren Camp Pine Lake in Eldora, Iowa. Online condolences may be directed to the family at Iowa Cremation. Doris Marie Ziegler, 94, of Strawberry Point, formerly of Fairbank, passed away on Good Friday, March 29th, at the Strawberry Point Lutheran Home in Strawberry Point. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Strawberry Point Lutheran Home or St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Orem. Funeral service will be 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd, at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Orem. Visitation will be at 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd, at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Orem. The interment is at St. Peter's Lutheran Church Cemetery, rural Fairbank. Charles Price Smith, 94, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, March 26th. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd at Lock on Fourth in Waterloo, with homegoing celebration at 11 a.m. Burial will be in the Garden of Memories Cemetery in Waterloo. Memorials may be directed to the family. In some sports news, the three-point line for the women's NCAA tournament at Moda Center had a discrepancy in distance at each end of the court that went unnoticed through four games over 2 days before Texas and North Carolina State were informed of the problem ahead of their Elite Eight matchup on Sunday. While the NCAA did not provide details, one three-point line near the top of the key appeared to be about 6 inches closer to the basket than at the opposite end of the floor. The NCAA three-point line is at 22 feet 1 3/4 inches for both women and men. The team's coaches agreed to play Sunday's game as scheduled with the mismatched three-point lines rather than delay it, the NCAA said in a statement. NC State beat Texas 76-66 to advance to the Final Four. Lynn Holzman, NCAA Vice President of Women's Basketball, said all lines would be measured after practices concluded on Sunday evening, and the correct markings would be on the floor ahead of Monday's game between Southern California and UConn. She said, while the NCAA's vendor has apologized for the area, we will investigate how this happened in the first place. The NCAA is working now to ensure the accuracy of all court markings for future games. We are not aware of any other issues at any of the prior sites for men's or women's tournament games. Connor Sports makes the March Madness floors for both men and women. We apologize for the error that was found and have technicians on site at the Moda Center in Portland who were instructed to make the necessary corrections immediately following Sunday's game, the company said in a statement. The court issue was another distraction for the NCAA during a women's tournament in which the play has been exceptional, but other issues have taken the spotlight. There was a referee pulled out of a game at halftime in the first round. Utah faced racist harassment before its first round game. Notre Dame's Hannah Hidalgo was forced to remove a nose ring and missed time in a Sweet 16 loss to Oregon State. LSU coach Kim Mulkey threatened to sue the Washington Post over a then unpublished profile of her, and later called out a Los Angeles Times columnist for what she said was sexist criticism of her team. The Times edited the column in response. And now, the court issue in Portland. Four Sweet 16 games on Friday and Saturday were played without any of the participating teams saying anything publicly about a problem with the court. During pregame warm-ups, Schaefer and NC State coach Wes Moore were informed that the three-point line distance at the top of the key was different on both ends of the floor. The distance between the top of the key and the three-point line was correct. NCAA officials were asked to measure the distance and brought out a tape measure about 15 minutes before tip-off. After discussions between NCAA representatives, the coaches, and officials, the game went on as scheduled. In college softball, Northern Iowa won the first two games of a three-game set with league-leading Southern Illinois over the weekend in Missouri Valley Conference softball action. On Saturday, Kylie Sanders blasted a two-run home run in the second inning to back up a 11-strikeout, three-hit complete game from Samantha Heyer in the circle. On Friday, the Panthers handed the Salukas their first conference loss of the season with a 2-1 win. Anna Wisnowski threw her fifth complete game of the season as she outdueled SIU freshman Maddie Groff. Groff had entered the game at 15-0. Alexis Pupilla's third-inning home run was the difference, as it broke a 1-1 tie. The Salukas took the final game of the series 9-1. Papilio's league-leading 11th home run in the sixth was the only run the Panthers mustered. You and I, 16-11 overall, 4-2 in the MVC, returns to action today at Iowa State in a 4 p.m. first pitch. In USHL hockey, Waterloo dropped a pair of weekend games to league-leading Fargo as the Forfs clinched the U.S. Hockey League's Anderson Cup. Friday, in a 6-1 loss, the Blackhawks scored first, 9 minutes and 42 seconds into the game on a Jackson Nevers tally, but Fargo used 3 power play goals to pull away. Saturday, Fargo scored twice in the third to break open a 2-all tie. Reed Morick tied the game at 1-all in the first period, and John Mustard's 26th goal of the season gave Waterloo a brief 2-1 lead the second. The Blackhawks host the Dubuque Fighting Saints tonight at Young Arena in a 7:05 p.m. first faceoff. And in other news, Iowa native and University of Iowa, Northern Iowa graduate Dr. W. Kimron Brathmel was recently selected by President Joe Biden to be the 17th director of the National Cancer Institute. As head of the NCI, Brathmel will pursue the main objectives of the Cancer Moonshot initiative set by the President and First Lady Jill Biden, to prevent more than 4 million cancer deaths by 2047 and to improve the experience of people who are touched by cancer. Brathmel credits her time in Iowa for setting her on a path to one of the most prestigious positions in her field. She and her two brothers grew up in Bellevue and Woodbine. Their parents, Ed and Sharon Meyer, were both teachers. She said interactions with the local doctor in town and other people in the medical field sparked an interest. Brathmel also worked at a nursing home during high school, which helped her decide she wanted to go into medicine. She graduated from Sheffield High School and received a presidential scholarship to the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, where she earned degrees in both chemistry and biology. Her time in Cedar Falls changed her life in a number of ways. Brathmel said two experiences and two mentors helped shape her future career path, studying the effects of acid rain on soybeans under the tutelage of Virginia Berg and studying the heart development in chicken embryos under Daryl Wines. Brathmel credits UNI for another major development in her life, she said. There was also a cute boy working in the same lab, she said. That boy was Jeff Brathmel, who would become her husband. Brathmel still has strong ties in the area. Her in-laws, Ed and Julie Brathmel, are still here. Ed was a math professor at UNI, and Julie was a high school teacher in Rhinebeck, she said. I was married in the First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Falls. I love the local area, and I get back once or twice a year. After graduating from UNI, Rathmel's list of accomplishments continued to grow. She went on to get her Ph.D. in biophysics and M.D. from Stanford University. She completed an internal medicine internship at the University of Chicago and an internal medicine residency, medical oncology fellowship, and postdoctoral studies at the University of Pennsylvania. In 2022, she completed her Master of Management in Healthcare from the Vanderbilt University Owen Graduate School of Management. She received the 2019 Louisa Nelson Award for Women of Achievement, Vision, and Inspiration, the 2019 Eugene P. Schoenfield Award from the Kidney Cancer Association, and the Paragon Award for Research Excellence from the Doris Duke Foundation. She was a leader of the Cancer Genome Atlas's kidney cancer projects and served as a TCGA analysis working group member across the spectrum of cancers, winning the 2020 American Association for Cancer Research Team Science Award. She has served on the NCI Board of Scientific Advisors and the Forbeck Foundation Scientific Advisory Board. She has held leadership positions with the American Society of Clinical Oncology and the American Society for Clinical Investigation, serving as Secretary, Treasurer, and President. As a result of her efforts, she was elected to the Association of American Physicians, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. Rathmel's specialty is the research and treatment of complex and hereditary kidney cancers. She also focuses on underlying drivers of kidney cancers using genetic, molecular, and cell biology to develop interventions to improve patients' lives. She has authored more than 250 articles in leading peer-reviewed journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, Nature, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and the Journal of Clinical Investigations. Prior to being sworn in as the NCI director, she led the Vanderbilt University Medical Center as physician-in-chief and chair of the Department of Medicine. Rathmel said there were a few months of interviewing and meeting with people before she was named NCI director, and then she got a call from the White House. She said, "It was thrilling once you realize who is on the phone. It was Dr. Jill Biden. You realize what a wonderful honor it is." After relocating from Tennessee to Bethesda, Maryland, Rathmel began her new position in December of 2023 and was formally sworn in on January 10th at the Hubert H. Humphrey Building in Washington, D.C., U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra administered the oath of office. Her children are out of the house. Son Peter is a lawyer, and daughter Dory is finishing graduate school in environmental science, but her husband remains in Nashville, where he is a professor at Vanderbilt University. Much of Rathmel's early career was focused on kidney cancer. "As a clinician, I was meeting patients with kidney cancer, and this is now 20-some years ago. And there were really no effective options for therapy, and the patients I would meet had a very short survival to be expected," she said in a recent interview released by the NCI. "It seemed like an opportunity for the science to drive something that was different, and I have to say in the next decade it delivered it so much more than that even. The discoveries from the laboratories helps us understand how that cancer works," she said, describing the advances in how long patients were living. "And today, kidney cancer is a completely different beast. It's got a number of fantastic therapies, and we can talk about a cure with patients." Rathmel believes her experience as a practicing physician, research educator, and administrator will serve her well in her new role, and that the goals of Cancer Moonshot are reachable. She says, "I am quite optimistic. The advances are happening, and they are happening fast. It is really an exciting time in cancer research." There is a fourth generation barber at the Cedar Falls shop. Eli Sohn was not initially sold on becoming a barber. At least 10 others in his family had professionally trimmed hair, but like many young people, he didn't know what he wanted to do. He graduated from Dyke New Hartford High School in 2019 and tried college, but realized it wasn't for him. He spent time working at a lumber yard. Then the idea popped up in conversation, and an admirable quality kicked in as he watched a Green Bay Packers game with relatives. "He's not a kid that says no. He thinks about it," said his grandmother, Alberta Simcox. Soane, 23, didn't take the suggestion of his aunt Deb Simcox too seriously. She co-owns the Simcox & Company Barbershop at 1525 West 1st Street with her son, Tom Irvin. The family has been in the haircutting business for decades. When her youngest nephew uttered, "I'll think about it," Deb Simcox says it was game on. The family made sure Soane kept the possibility at the forefront of his mind. Eventually, he pursued cutting hair as a career. "I saw it as a good opportunity to be with family at a time when I didn't know what I wanted to do after graduating from high school," said Soane. Soane spent a little more than a year at the Salon Professional Academy, started at the family shop in May, and has found his calling. He enjoys talking sports with the customers. Soane's grandmother is married to Jack Simcox, 87. He went to work in the family's original barbershop, founded in the 1940s on South Street in Waterloo. He later became the longtime co-owner of Simcox and Fink with Dean Fink. It closed in 2011 after more than 50 years in business with Deb Simcox and Fink at the helm, according to Courier Archives. The new Simcox Barbershop opened in 2021. The family ties are not always known by those who walk inside, but they are always on display. The grandparents say their grandson has done a good job and given them another reason to be proud of the family trade. He works in the chair, second from the right, 5 days per week, in between his aunt and cousin. Family photos hang in the background. Grandfather comes in to get a haircut once every month or so. "When they see me, they know the place better be cleaned up," said Jack Simcox, who's been retired for more than 20 years. He sometimes picks up a broom if there is hair on the floor. His piece of the history extends beyond his love of the broom, though. It's the people. Soane said about his grandfather, "It's cool because he'll run into people whose hair he used to trim when they were 7 years old." He is emphatic about enjoying the clients just like his grandfather. The family business is also a way to keep tabs on what's happening with relatives, and they like to joke around. Irvin, Soane's cousin, was giving him a hard time for oftentimes saying, "That's crazy," in conversation with clients. But at the end of the day, the business's growth depends on the three connected by blood in the fourth generation operation. His grandparents hear about the successes and triumphs, too, while they're there. Alberta Simcox recalled hearing about how water was flying everywhere as their grandson tried to keep pace with the number of people walking through the doors on a busy day. "He's a bit more relaxed now," she noted, "but he can't recall how many people he sees on an average day. He says that's because I just go." What's also flowing by is time in Cedar Falls. Jack Simcox points out the growth in population and commerce, but also the technology. About a half dozen televisions on the wall give people something to do while waiting. The screens also keep the little ones from moving their heads while the clippers are in action. And we end with a little business news. UPS will become the primary air cargo provider for the U.S. Postal Service. The Atlanta Shipping Company said Monday that it had received an air cargo contract that significantly expands an existing partnership between the two. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.